Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Travelers would be wise to pack as lightly as possible for their carry-on and to minimize clutter so that we can make the process go more quickly.
Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff speaking earlier this morning after the 21 arrests in London and the heightened alert, the first ever red alert that's only for incoming flights from the UK after this alleged terror plot was disrupted. Orange alert for everything else, which is pretty much the condition we're in the New York City area generally. We are going to go back to Newark Airport briefly now, where WNYC's Bob Henley is. Bob, what's the scene there?
I've now moved down, Brian, to the international portion of arriving flights in Terminal C in Newark, waiting with folks for a incoming flight from Dublin that's running a few minutes behind. The atmosphere has calmed down considerably since we last talked, with systems clearly up and running and the public more aware, and indeed the staff here clearer about what needs to be done.
Now, apparently this plot was against American Airlines, United Airlines, and Continental Airlines planes in particular, according to the information that the British officials believe they have accurately after these arrests. Is anything different in the terminals or for the flights from those airlines and anything else at Newark right now?
It would appear from the arrival area here that the cordon for arriving guests is pushed back a bit. That is to say, the public is closer to the door, and there is more of a uniform presence than normal.
And you know, there's the scene, I guess, with liquids now not being allowed on the planes, of people throwing away water bottles and juice boxes and things like that. What's that been like for travelers?
Frustrating. Also, I might add, you know, in this day and age, it's very common with the way we live to have minor children travel unescorted with extensive interaction with the airport. And I did speak with one airline, and I did speak with one father who had that special clearance to go and meet his son who had flown in from Charlottesville. And he had been pushed back and told to wait almost on the sidewalk. And so there was great apprehension there. I'm glad to report they finally were reunited. But that's one of the things we take for granted now, especially with families split up, you know, kids on visitation. And so it can be a real stress to have youngsters in this kind of situation with their guardians not near them, and they're in the custody of the airline until, of course, they connect with their parents.
What do they do about babies' bottles?
Well, one of the frustrating things, of course, is things like diaper gel and the rest. Those things are pretty much, unless you can pack it in something that's going to be checked below, then you have to deal with the fact you're not going to have it in flight. And that is, I did interview a couple of new moms who were apprehensive about it, and already it's tough to travel with small kids, as I know you know, and so add this extra angst, and it can be a challenge.
WNYC's Bob Henley at Newark Airport. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And in a little while, we'll talk to Guy Martin, the terrorism columnist for Condé Nast Traveler, more about the practical aspects of the new restrictions. Well, us and them seems to be a favorite human organizing tool. The war on terror is seen by many in the Muslim world and probably elsewhere, truth be told, as a war against Islam or against militant Islam. But Islam is hardly a monolithic entity. Within Islam, there's a big divide now making its presence felt in Iraq between the Sunnis and the Shiites. This is a big historical divide. Al-Qaeda tends to be Sunni. Hezbollah tends to be Shiite. So what do these differences mean within the Islamic world, and how might they shape U.S. policies? Vali Nasser is an expert on Iran and the Shiites, and he has written a new book that looks at some of these questions. It's called The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future, from W.W. Norton, and he joins me now. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with the religious schism or schism itself, as you do in the book, with when and why the Shiites split away to form their own branch of Islam many years ago?
This is very much like a major divide that you have in Christianity between Protestants and Catholics. It goes back to the very beginning of the Islamic faith. When the Islamic prophet Muhammad died, there was a dispute over who should replace him. and that dispute eventually created one group to separate from the others. And over time, each became a separate interpretation of Islam. So they interpret the text, the law, what meaning of spirituality and practice of faith is, rather differently from one another. And each one thinks that they have it right and they are the original orthodoxy.
And do I understand correctly that though this was a religious dispute, it was also rooted in political dissent?
Yes, from the very beginning it was, because Prophet Muhammad, much like the Judaic prophets, was both prophet and ruler when he was there. And there was a community to be ruled after he died. And therefore, this claim to who holds religious truth was also a claim to who should be ruling over Muslims.
And the was there something about, do I understand correctly from your book, the way the religious leaders became political leaders is all at all the kind of politicization of early Islamic leaders?
There was, but it's not like the politicization we're seeing today. Early Islamic leaders, particularly in the medieval period when they ruled over Baghdad or Damascus, were more like sort of Constantine or Charlemagne in European history, or like the King of England, who's head of church and king of country. But they didn't have a real religious claim. This kind of mixing of religion and politics that we see today in the Middle East is something different.
Vali Nasser is my guest on WNYC. His book is The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. And we can take your phone calls for him. Sunni Muslims listening, please call in. Shia Muslims listening, please call in. Anyone else, give us a call with a comment or a question for Professor Nasser at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Vali Nasser, a professor of Middle East and South Asia politics at the Naval Postgraduate School and an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Who goes to the Naval Postgraduate School?
Mostly officers do, whose career path is analysis of politics and countries. So they study languages, they study cultures, and they also want to learn about international relations. That's at least in my department, but there are also engineers and business programs and things of that sort as well.
And so how do you teach Middle East and South Asia politics to Navy officers with any different focus than you would to anyone else?
Well, they're not only Navy officers. They're, for instance, Marines, Army, and the focus, our function is to teach them about the culture, history. In other words, provide them with an understanding that then allows them to do their analysis.
You use in the book the Shiite celebration of Ashura as the biggest signifier of the split between Shiite and Sunni. It's where the Shiites get together and publicly declare their beliefs, and the Sunnis are then banded together as not observing or branded as not observing. Can you describe the religious festival?
Yes, it's a festival that revolves around the death of the third Shiite imam, as it's called, or Shiite saint, who was a grandson of the Prophet, who in the 7th century claimed that he had the right to rule over the Muslim community. He was defeated and massacred in a battle at the city of Karbala, which is in today's Iraq. And the Shiites every year commemorate his death. And that's the one event which makes Shiites very different from Sunnis, because it's an event that is not reflected in text, in religious scripture. The Sunnis don't observe it. They don't believe there is any basis for it in religion. But for the Shiites, that event was much like the crucifixion of Christ. It was the very formation and consolidation of their faith.
So when we look at the situation of Iraq, I mean, there are all kinds of more recent politics that inform the sectarian strife there. But how much do you think can be traced to fundamental religious differences between the Sunni Muslim minority and the Shiite Muslim majority?
Well, the theological difference is important because it makes you separate from how Islam is practiced, say, by your neighbor. But also these two communities have a long history together. And history is important because over other periods of time they fought with one another, and there is a memory of that. Much like, say, if you looked at Northern Ireland, when Protestants and Catholics fight each other, It's not about whether they actually go to church. It's memory of what happened in the 16th century and what did the British do in the 15th century. And it's almost like an ethnic identity. So Shiites see themselves as Shiites, not by faith only, but because they're different.
And if somebody said, with respect to the 15th or 16th century, get over it, what would they say?
Well, yes, they have to get over it. But, you know, these things, as we're seeing in Northern Ireland, these kinds of healings of wounds and forgetting of history has to happen gradually. I always remember that during the Yugoslav War, the biggest gripe of the Serbs was the battle they lost in the 1400s to the Turks. And they still held Bosnian Muslims responsible for the battle that was lost before. So historical memory is often far more important in modern times than we like to think, and is a cause of a lot of problems.
Well, they say we need to have the reverence to remember. They say this in all kinds of cultures and countries. Maybe you also sometimes need the courage to forget.
Definitely, but part of the problem in the Middle East is that actually the violence that's occurring is creating new memories for future generations that would then be just as difficult to forget. And as every one of these massacres in Baghdad is something that 50 years, 100 years from now will still cause other conflict.
A big symbolic signifier. Ken in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Vali Nasser, author of The Shia Revival.
Hello. This might just be idle historical curiosity, but there's so many features of Shiite practice that resemble Christianity. Many, many. I mean, the crucifixion has come up. There's also a Messiah who comes back, and you know, the 12 imams and the 12 apostles and different orientation. Well, with regard to, you know, graphic images and so on and so forth, there are many, many Christian-like features. And I'm just wondering if today's Shia may trace back to a population that was, well, Christian at the time of the original expansion of Islam.
The similarities you point to are true. Particularly, Shiism has a lot of similarity to Catholicism. You know, Shia ayatollahs are like bishops or cardinals. The Shiites, like the Catholics, believe in saints and that there is an intermediary between man and God, and that they are specially revered. But the origins don't, actually. The origins, if there was any influence at that time in the Middle East, came from ancient Iranian or Greek or Egyptian practices. And in fact, you know, even in the early Christian history itself, there was a lot of influence from Manichaean and other Mithraic sects of ancient Iranians who inhabited the Middle East. But I think the similarities are more coincidental in that what you see in Shiism and Catholicism is reflective of similar approaches to what faith means and what relationship of man to God is than actually having an actual concrete historical connection.
Ken, thank you for an interesting call. We're going to take a short break, then we will continue with more of your phone calls and emails for Vali Nasser, author of The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. We'll pass along one piece of news from the Middle East and perhaps get Professor Nasser's reaction when we come back. This is not necessarily related to the arrests in Britain today, but Jordanian airport officials say a man tried to force his way into the cockpit of a Qatari Airways flight in Amman, but the plane returned safely to Amman, so little other information on that right now, and no indication that it's related to the terror arrests in the UK. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest is Islam expert Vali Nasser, who teaches at the Naval Postgraduate Academy in Monterey, California. He's also an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he has a new book called The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Now, it's mostly Shiites, I guess, I guess I shouldn't say that. The United States right now is concerned about Sunnis to the extent that Al-Qaeda is a Sunni-based organization, concerned about Shias, with respect to Iran, a Shiite country. And if I understand correctly, you have a warning in your book, or you quote a warning in your book to a Western diplomat that the real problem will be the Sunnis. Give us the context for that.
Well, this was a story that went back to the 1980s when, at that time, Islamic fundamentalism or militancy was associated with Iran and Hezbollah and the attacks on the Marine barracks in Lebanon. And this gentleman who was a Pakistani Shia was teased by his American counterpart that, you know, the Shias were the problem. And his answer was that the Shias were usually an underdog and their extremism came from trying to assert their rights, but that ultimately the U.S. would be confronted with a far larger anger among the Sunnis, which manifested itself sometime later in the form of Al-Qaeda. And in some ways, sort of that's a context that, you know, the U.S. began encountering this issue of the challenge of Islam by Iranian Revolution in 1979. Then the past decade, most of the challenge in the region has come from Sunni groups, Al-Qaeda at a global level and the insurgents in Iraq at the local level. And the current fighting between Hezbollah and Israel is a new chapter, although it still does not involve the United States. It's a dispute over borders and territory and localized in the Arab-Israeli context.
I wonder if you have an opinion about whether Hezbollah has designs on becoming a more global or, let's say, more particularly anti-U.S. military or terrorist organization. It's, of course, been focused on southern Lebanon and Israel traditionally, but there are those who say that Hezbollah now has greater designs. What do you think?
It has greater designs, but I think its greatest design is taking control of Lebanon. Hezbollah is very different from Al-Qaeda in the sense that Al-Qaeda is a small group that has no relationship to a society. It's a set of individuals, idealistic, nihilistic, violent, who hope to jumpstart a movement, but don't have any relationship to a concrete territory or a people. Hezbollah is a lot more like the IRA. In other words, its violence and its anti-Americanism, anti-Israeli attitude should not be confused with the fact that it actually has a territorial agenda and a political agenda. It also is based in society in Lebanon. It's a very different movement. It emerged first as an anti-American and anti-Israeli force. That's its history. That's the beginning for Hezbollah, was the fight to push Israel out of South Lebanon. And it still sees Israel and the U.S. as a main obstacle to its consolidation of power in Lebanon. I think Hezbollah in some ways saw the departure of the Syrian troops as a threat to itself and decided to take action. And it hopes that by doing this, it's going to gain greater popularity.
By the way, I mentioned that report from Amman earlier. Mm-hmm. Now an updated report says an official does not think that passenger was trying to hijack the plane when he tried to force his way into the cockpit of a Qatari Airways flight. So at least from what the word is from Amman right now, nothing much there. Carlos in Queens, you're on WNYC with Vali Nasser. Hello.
Hello, Professor Nasser. I just wanted to ask you a question about, it kind of relates to what the other gentleman said, but in regards to Zoroastrianism, it seems that Shia Islam sort of coincides geographically with the ancient Zoroastrian heartland. I mean, is Shia Islam, maybe could it be also like an adaptation of Islam for what was a more national, you know, more entrenched religion and older, like Zoroastrianism?
Well, it's possible. First of all, you know, when religions grow roots in societies, they have to adapt to the local culture. So, for instance, when Christianity came out of Palestine and settled in Europe, it adapted to Northern European culture, including, for instance, the symbolism of the Christmas tree. For instance, there were no such trees in Palestine at the time of Jesus, but it was a part of the you know, cultural landscape of Northern Europe. Similar things have happened to Islam as it has gone to different cultural areas, to sub-Saharan Africa, to Asia, to Central Asia, and to Iran. It has absorbed many of the local customs, sometimes outright making it part of its practice, and sometimes sort of finding ways to relate to local people through their cultural language. So even if today you looked at the way Iranians practice Shiism, it's a little bit different from the way the Arabs or the Pakistanis practice Shiism. The Pakistanis, for instance, you may see more similarities to Hinduism. And in the Arab world, you don't see some of these Zoroastrian, ancient Iranian, or Hindu influences.
My guest, Vali Nasser, Council on Foreign Relations, Adjunct Senior Fellow, and professor at the Naval Postgraduate Academy, and author now of the book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. And yes, there are conflicts within Islam, and there are certainly American concerns about the Shia-Sunni conflict in Iraq, but there are other situations in which they intertwine, and it's not that neat, and it's not that clear. We were talking about Hezbollah, a Shiite organization, but it enjoys Syria's support, which is Sunni-ruled. The Palestinians are predominantly Sunni Muslims, yet we see the Sunni Hamas and the Shia Hezbollah with similar goals, at least with respect to Israel. So how much does the split really mean in geopolitical terms?
Well, Hezbollah and Iran, both of them don't want to focus on the Shia-Sunni issue. They prefer to focus on issues that brings everybody together, which means the issue of Israel, the issue of Palestinians. And they don't characterize themselves as Shia. They characterize themselves as Muslim. It is usually the Sunnis who have raised the sectarian issue. When Hezbollah's war with Israel began, it was Arab governments and then radical Sunni clerics who criticized Hezbollah and asked the average guy on the street not to look to them. So right now you have two tendencies in the Middle East. One, you have Iraq, where the Shia-Sunni issue is pulling them apart. And then you have the Lebanon war, which is making common cause between Shias and Sunnis. And you have this Hezbollah leader popular across Sunni countries. So, and the interesting thing would be that which will come to win the day, whether the model of Iraq will dominate and we're going to see a lot of conflict, or whether this fight against Israel for the cause of the Palestinians will bring them together with Hezbollah.
Let's take another call. Imad in Hasbrook Heights. You're on WNYC. Hello, Imad.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask the professor about Hezbollah, in his opinion.
Okay. Imad, hang on. I'm going to need to jump in and interrupt for a few minutes. We're going to go live to a statement being given by Mayor Bloomberg with respect to the terror arrest in the UK and the red and orange alerts at airports in this country. We go now live to Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
I think both will be out in the next day or so from the hospital, and I express the city's gratitude for the work that they do. They're assigned to the 106th precinct. They were working in the 90th in Brooklyn when the accident occurred.
Mayor Bloomberg talking about injured New York City police officers right now. We expect him to get in just a minute to the security situation.
Corrections Officer Chief Robert Dash, who has some medical problems, and he was sort of very groggy, and so I really didn't have much of a chance to talk to him.
Okay. In fact, we will return to the mayor when he is talking about the terror situation. So let's get back to Imad from Hasbrook Heights and his phone call. Imad, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you. I just want his opinion, the professor, about Hezbollah, if they are a terrorist group or they are just a resistance group. And if they are just trying to get rid of the occupation, why we keep labeling them as a terrorist group?
Well,
and if he had any kind of terrorist before, if he's aware of it, to let us know.
Okay, and we will get the answer to that question, but Mayor Bloomberg has now moved on to the security situation, and we move on back to him.
Country, we were told that commercial jets departing from Manchester and Heathrow airports in the UK, destined for New York and other cities in the U.S., were targeted for mid-air bombing with devices disguised as drinks and other liquids. Obviously, this is an ongoing investigation, one that has already led to 21 arrests in the United Kingdom, and we cannot and will not say anything about it that might impede efforts to disrupt this conspiracy and to apprehend anyone who may have been involved in it. That said, clearly this was a very serious plot, one that Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff has described as well-planned and well-advanced, international in scope, and with the potential to inflict considerable loss of life. The stepped-up air travel security measures announced by Secretary Chertoff earlier today, including the ban on most carry-on liquids, will in all likelihood result in longer lines at security checkpoints of people traveling with through the region's airports, and I just ask everybody to be understanding. We will do whatever it takes to keep people safe, and if it's an inconvenience, it's just something that we're going to have to learn how to deal with. I did speak to Governor Pataki earlier this morning, and he posted me on the measures that the Port Authority Police Department are taking. There's additional security measures at New York City airports, and if the National Guard is needed, the governor certainly said he would make those available. Given the seriousness of the plot, these security measures, while creating an inconvenience, really are necessary and utterly reasonable, and I'm sure the vast majority of travelers will agree with that. It is very comforting, even if it's annoying, to see your security being taken seriously. Anyone planning to leave by air from New York certainly should plan on getting to the airport several hours earlier in order to make their scheduled departures while these measures are in effect. And in terms of today, if you're planning to fly to London, you certainly should call your carrier and see if that is possible. You may have to postpone your trip. As we do with all intelligence information from around the world, we are incorporating what we've learned about conspiracies and into our counterterrorism planning. The city remains at a level orange security level, the same level that we've maintained since September 11th, 2001. The nature of this plot doesn't lend itself to the kind of added high-profile police presence that we have instituted in the wake of other terrorist plots or attacks, such as the July 2005 bombings of subways in London. Our ongoing and robust counterterrorism activities in New York include subway baggage searches, protection and surveillance of bridges and other key infrastructure installations, and the activation of the NYPD Hercules teams. And all of those things will continue. Let us all remember that the secret weapon that will win the war against terrorism is courage. The best thing we can do is to continue to go about our daily lives, leaving the investigation to the experts and the security of our wonderful city to the best police department in the world, and show that we will not be intimidated by criminal conspiracies like this one. I'll be happy to take a question or two if anybody has one. Miss. That's correct.
What measures were taken to increase security at this time?
The NYPD was informed of the ongoing investigations, and that was incorporated into our ongoing protection of this city, which, as you know, we try to change so that it's not predictable at all. And anything that we learned was part of the overall plan each day that the police department comes up with and how they deploy their resources. And I'm really not at liberty to say anything else. Miss? We can't hear you. I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry. Was any members of that cell who... To the best of our knowledge, there are no members of this group here. They were all in the UK, and their investigation continues. Sir?
Sir, you said there are no high-profile measures that you can take, but are you in the police department increasing intelligence gathering on the possibility that sympathizers...
Well, we have 1,000 police officers devoted to intelligence and counterterrorism. We have our own police officers around the world, including in London. where having somebody on the ground helps us in understanding what this plot was about. But keep in mind, the Port Authority Police Department that provides security at the individual airports, they're getting the information too, and they will make sure that their security measures in terms of how you get through security and onto planes incorporates everything that they've learned from this particular case. Sir. No, in this case, the place you will see added security is at the airports. But in terms of what we do to protect our subways and our bridges and all other potential targets, that goes on. And this, we are at our Operation Orange. You can see sometimes police cars. They may be annoying on bridges where they cut traffic down by a lane, but that's what we think at the moment we have to do. It may be delayed if you have your bag searched at a subway stop. That's what we think we have to do. In the case of responding to this particular thing yesterday, that's really enhancing security at the airports, and you will see enhanced additional Port Authority police officers there, sir. Well, I think it's up to the people that provide the security at the airports to decide what is appropriate. What we'd like to do is that people be able to come and go without being annoyed. That's not possible in this world. We are going to have security. The question is what level and what's the appropriate things to look at, look for. Each of the different governments are going to have to decide, and that's what Michael Chertoff and the FAA and Port Authority Police they're wrestling with that all the time. At what point do you say enough is enough? And in retrospect, if nothing happens, if you didn't catch anything, you didn't need it. But the real world is you can't go without it, miss.
All right. Live coverage of a news conference by Mayor Bloomberg announcing stepped up security at the airports, but really nothing else that he expects New Yorkers to notice or that he's asking New Yorkers to act on. This, of course, in response to the announcement by officials in the UK that they have broken up an alleged terrorist plot that would have attempted to bomb multiple airplanes flying from the UK to the US. 21 people were arrested in Great Britain today. Nobody in the United States, and there is no indication from the authorities that any of this was being planned or organized in any way inside the borders of the United States. This was allegedly a one-way plot regarding airliners flying from the UK to the United States. There is a red alert in effect, the highest security alert, the first U.S. red alert, but it's only in effect for flights from the UK to the United States. President Bush is expected to make a statement about this in about 10 minutes, which we will also carry live. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.